The Money Show.
Business Unusual with Colin Cullis.
Finally, Colin, a Nobel Prize on the only issue that really matters, particularly for us, and that is alleviating poverty.
Yes, and it's very good to see that it was awarded, the three researchers, and it gave me the opportunity to look at not just the quite unusual research that they do, but three other stories that I've sort of had on the background that on their own weren't unusual enough, but combining these four just might give you a very unusual sort of things. And the four stories are how better research can lead to better programs to combat poverty, how you can earn money for doing nothing.
Yes, I'm in.
Yeah. How being poor causes you to make bad decisions, and how you're supposed to pay for lifting the poor out of poverty. So the first one definitely relates to the economic prize, the Nobel Prize that was issued. And these researchers, rather than most of the other economic prizes, were awarded for the work that was done on theoretical models in pure economics that over many, many years were found to show either to be highly, you know, aligned at being able to see trends and predict things because of how they use massive amounts of data. These winners' data was all achieved in this century. And they test very small things. It's the small data test that they do. But they use the kind of testing that we use in drug trials. Some people will receive the thing, others will not. You compare the differences and work out how effective was it. Typically with development economics and the way societies do social policy is they work on everybody getting the thing and trusting that somebody more clever than them worked out why it was a good idea. And one example, for example, that they did was testing the allocation of textbooks in Kenya. Now, South Africans remember allocations of textbooks. Well, that's not something we're used to having some challenges with. But they questioned, is the textbook going to make the biggest difference for improving kids' results? And they did the test, again, looking at some students who would get it and some didn't. And what they found that is textbooks help kids who are already pretty good academically and probably a little further along. It did almost nothing for those who weren't that proficient at English and lacked the actual skills to be able to use the content of the textbooks. So a very expensive tool was issued and given to everybody, and then everybody was sort of disappointed that, well, we did the textbook and we didn't get the results.
Isn't it funny? Because we assume, and it's like you give somebody something and say, now work with it.
Yes.
And it's in the application of the gift or the tool that it really matters. I mean, the land debate in South Africa is similar. Why have so many land projects failed? Well, people have been dumped on land and not given any skills or tools and have been told to make it work. And it's nigh impossible if you're not properly equipped to do it. So, I mean, in the same way, it should be perfectly logical. But I'm glad that there's some research to prove it.
Yeah, and where it really gets useful is that somebody comes up with what would other be called a crazy idea. And they say, well, we're never going to support that. It makes no sense. And it's going to be far too expensive. And then somebody says, well, let's give it a go and see if it works. And then calculate the costs based on the effectiveness. And a similar test was done in India. And rather than just supplying textbooks, they allocated tutors for 2 hours a day to the kids that were struggling the most. And they got a remarkable improvement in those kids' improvements to their scores. And the improvement stuck with them even after the intervention had stopped.
There is no substitute for great teaching. I mean, if you have an inspirational teacher, I hope everybody's had at least one inspirational teacher in their lives, somebody who's made a difference in their lives, and that one inspirational teacher can make your love for a particular subject or a particular series of subjects absolutely remarkable. And if you have a series of lousy teachers, you're going to drain any enthusiasm you could ever have for education.
Exactly right. So now we move on to the second one, earning money for doing nothing. Now, the wealthy will be very happy to know that in research, poor people have said, no, you can't get money for doing nothing. Even though, and I'm pretty sure Warren Ingram often will tell you, well, that's the very definition of what a good investment is. You put the money in and it allows you to get money back for doing nothing. Wealthy will point out.
Well, you've made a decision and you've applied the capital and other people are doing the work. So you're not doing nothing. You've made a decision. You've taken an active course of action.
Well, you're not doing anything. You've given it to somebody else to do it. Now, you needed the funds in the first place to invest it. You needed to make a pretty good decision in where you invest it. And you get the returns when the markets are good. And this one particularly relates to Oxfam, who earlier this year had pointed out if you just took just three billionaires, and there's not only three, but using just three billionaires, two of them were South Africans, they have the same amount of wealth as 650 poorest Africans. 50%.
650 million.
Correct.
Poorest
Africans. Oh, sorry, did I say 650?
You did.
No, slightly more than 650 million. And the point wasn't that 650 million poor Africans are working as hard as those three billionaires. It's that the investments and what's giving them a return on any investment for wealth is not working half as well as it is for the billionaire. So if a sort of a sovereign fund could be created of that sort of size, that would work as well as it did for the billionaires, then you have a pot of money from which to start addressing the challenges, these programs with good research. And that comes to the third one. Poor people make bad decisions. And people kind of instinctively say, yeah, we know poor always make bad decisions, but they didn't really know why. In 2013, they did some experiments, and these are simplified sort of results, and I'm not saying they're completely the de facto reasons, but they do start pointing to why that would be. The tests are quite simple. They took a group in the US and a group in India, and they asked part of the group who were similarly economic. They were sort of financially under strain, and asked the one group, the US group, were told, how would you, or consider how you would pay for a car repair if you didn't have enough funds to cover it right now? Okay. And then they gave them a test and asked them to fill in some answers to a cognitive test. And the other group didn't get asked that challenging thing and see how they performed. The group that was asked to think about the car repair performed worse. And effectively what they're saying is, when you have to consider really difficult financial things, you strap for cash, you've got very little capacity left for dealing with other things you may have to contend with.
If you're under financial strain, and if you've ever been out of a job and you have for a moment had to consider making choices, do you pay the rent this month? Do you pay the school fees this month? Or do you actually make sure that there's money for food next month, because there's no guarantee that there's going to be any income next month? So you can keep the school at bay, you can keep the landlord at bay perhaps for a couple of days, and you hope that something's going to break and something's going to go your way, because if there's no food in the house, that's possibly the worst choice you can make. So you make difficult economic choices. And those difficult economic choices could see you homeless, your child chucked out of school, and you're not getting great food anyway.
And somebody not in that position, they'd look at you and say, well, why would you do that? That's obviously a bad idea. Why weren't you thinking about the future? And the point is, you don't have the capacity to think about the future. You will make bad decisions. And I suppose if you think about a business in a bit of trouble, they tend to make the same bad decisions, even though a business that was in that trouble would have nothing with it. So now you get to the sort of really challenging bit, and it says, well, then who or how would you pay for all of these things? And a little bit like last year's economic prize winners, the suggestion or the answer potentially lies in taxes. Now, it's fair to say that anybody who has to deal and has managed to generate a lot of money, they say, well, the last group of people you want to give your money to and think it's going to work is a government. That's the best place to have your money squandered and not used in the right ways, etc. However, there are few other alternatives for being able to do this. And again, that same Oxfam report refers to the wealth held in Africa, that 75% of it is being held offshore, because it's far more tax efficient to do so. Effectively taking away $14 billion was their estimate in tax revenues.
So if you reduce tax revenue, you reduce tax rates, the theory goes, and you make it more attractive because you may get a better yield in your home country, and people have faith that you're not going to change the tax laws back to a draconian scheme or put in exchange controls to limit their ability to get their money offshore. If you introduce some faith back into the system, people will trust the system, bring their money back, and then pay their taxes here rather than elsewhere.
That, and a lot of the wealthy pay a lot of money to foundations and charities. It's not that they're not willing to pay. There seems to be something that says, don't judge me for where I got this money. Just take it and know that it'll must do good somewhere. Because effectively, if you can look after future consumers that'll consume things from your brand and whatever else, well, that benefits you. So those are effectively investments by the wealthy to get a return later on. The challenge would be to say, how do you get the trust of the wealthy to hand it over to a government? And then for a government, which in itself is a sort of 5-year short term, doesn't have capacity to deal with making good long term decisions, typically only ever generates large sums of money for itself by taking unsustainable debt. So when you can get these things, and that's why all four of these stories have to come together in a very beautiful, unusual way, we can get somewhere. But maybe there is still hope for this, because if you remember how Alfred Nobel came to create the Nobel Prizes, he happened to read a French publication's mistaken belief that his brother had died was him. Yes. And the headline was, "The Merchant of Death is Dead." And he did not want that legacy.
Because he was a dynamite merchant, was he not?
He invented dynamite, and he didn't want to be known as the guy who created this thing that was terrible. And so by creating the fund, didn't give anything to his family members, and created these Nobel Prizes, he's got a much better legacy. So for all of the wealthy, learn from the Nobel laureates, from the people who say that the poor don't make bad decisions because they're poor. They make bad decisions because they lack cash. Give them the money. Find it from the kind of things that are sustainable, sovereign funds, to pay for them with the best practices around the world. Maybe then we've got a chance.
Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, pulling together some interesting threads to a very compelling argument. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual.